as far as where it is right now in the United States in specific bills that are in Congress. And let me set it very briefly, historically, as far as the Lutheran Church, which most of us are in. I hope I'm not leaving somebody out if I talk primarily the Lutheran attitude toward peace, war, and therefore also what young people in the Lutheran Church can look to as our heritage when they face the dilemma of registration, draft, military service, and so forth. For most of the young people that are affected by this, and when Jim Smith said 18-year-olds, anything I've read, if there is a registration, it's 18 through 26-year-olds, so it's a wider range than he said at the microphone. For most of the people in that age category, the idea of registration and draft is very new because we haven't had it since 1972. And if you go 7 years back, those 18-year-olds were 11 years old when that draft ended. And the idea of peacetime draft, there are people who say it's even against the Constitution of the United States. So it could be sometime along the line that you would have a court case on whether or not there can be a peacetime draft. But we have had it. We didn't have it in our history. In fact, the Founding Fathers tried to ensure against it. But we did have it after World War II. So there is precedent, and it was not challenged in the courts at that time, to my knowledge. My understanding of the possibilities, and very real possibilities, in fact, they are more and more real in that people who said we didn't need it before, including military people, now are saying that the AVF, all volunteer forces, is not working very well. So you have both some Congress people and the Pentagon saying that we probably need some form of military draft. The stages are that it probably will come first as registration, and that is out of committee anyway and is in front of congressional. It will probably be voted on this summer. A registration without draft first. That's almost everybody's prediction. When National Interreligious Service Board for Conscientious Objectors, which publishes a reporter, and for 4 years I was representing the American Lutheran Church in that group. I know them well. I think they're good people. They obviously are not objective. They represent basically the Brethren, Quakers, and Mennonites to ensure that the young people in those denominations have someone in Washington, D.C. who keeps an update and lets them know about their rights. But they are a very objective, they are not rabid. The director of that, Warren Hoover, is a Brethren pastor. He is a personal saint. He has fought arthritis for all of his years, and the only way he gets going every morning is a therapy pool for an hour. He's a remarkable man. They say that even when they call the office of those people who are most for a draft, Senator Nunn, Georgia, Armed Service Committee of Congress, Pentagon, almost everyone says we could not get it right now if we ask for it, so that probably what we will have first is a drive to have everyone registered. Registered without a draft is my prediction for what will be come first. There are 6 bills in Congress with a lot of variety on what that might be. Let me read one for you. Representative Charles Bennett, a Democrat of Florida, House of Representatives Bill 23. The President would order the Selective Service to commence registration of young men by October 1, 1979. A lot of them have women also being registered. This one does not. The President to report to Congress no later than June 30, 1979 on plans for the proposed registration. The Selective Service becomes a part of the Defense Department, and the Privacy Act is to be amended to permit the draft agency to obtain registration data from schools and other government agencies, including your Social Security card, anytime you've gotten on anybody's computer. Many believe that this bill has the best chance of passage. That sets up a registration. And it also asks Congress to set aside the Privacy Act. Let me explain that a little bit, because I think that's going to be one of the debates. There is very little money right now funding the Selective Service Department. They have very few people working and no apparatus, no local draft boards, places where you'd come to register. for them to envision the task of setting up that whole apparatus is very slow and quite costly, even though the proposals for selective service in Carter's budget next year are many millions more than this year, and 1980 and 81 fiscal year are many times more, again, in millions than this year. But if they could set aside the Privacy Act, they could go from computer to computer, apparently, and get all the information they need without anybody having to line up and register and set up all that apparatus. Obviously, a lot of groups are very opposed to the Privacy Act being set aside in order for your name to go on the Selective Service computer. You don't have any human interaction with anybody at that point. Most people think that's the most likely because it's very efficient, doesn't cost much, and is very quick. Let me give you another aspect to it, and several of you have read the book on the national service debate. Another possibility is that either alongside of registration or in conjunction with it or instead of it, you might get something called a National Service Act. This is, if you're fascinated by politics, and I think tonight we're going to be talking about very real issues and not an academic discussion about political intrigue, but if you're fascinated by politics, this is really a fascinating one. This has almost all of the Armed Service Committee in favor of it, all of those traditional service people, and it tends to be Southern congressmen and senators. It just, I don't know why that's true, but the list of those who are for reenactment of the draft tend to be a block of conservative congresspeople. And Mark Hatfield and Teddy Kennedy and Andrew Young, all for different reasons, are together on what they say is a good idea, and that's a National Service Act. Some of them don't want the military as any part of it at all. Some of them want it linked to the military, but they all think it would be a good thing to have a national service. Let me tell you what that is. This is Paul McCloskey, liberal congressman, as far as I know. Home Rule Bill 2206, and he put it in the hopper on February 15th of this year. This bill would require all 17-year-old men and women register with a national service system. Now, registrants would be required to choose either 2 years in the armed forces or 6 years in the reserve or 1 year of civilian service. Those are your three choices. 2 years in the armed forces, 6 years in the reserve, or 1 year of civilian service, or take your chance on a military draft and then you don't have any choice after that. In other words, the civilian service is an option, including, in McCloskey's idea, an option for the CO. In fact, he has no other options if he's given an option of civilian service. Okay? Registrants could defer their service to any time between the ages of 18 and 23. It's another option. You register at age 17. You can say when you want to give your service, and you have three choices, or you take your chances with the draft. Amy, I'm coming to it.
This is, if you were to defer and go for the draft, your chance with the draft, you got drafted, then you would have no choice whether you went to the civilian service.
No. The McCloskey bill would not change any of the provisions of the current Military Selective Service Act with regard to conditions for conscientious objection in time of war. During these times, COs would be required only to register. During peacetime, however, there are no provisions in the legislation for any classification as a conscientious objector. During any period other than a period of war declared by Congress, only persons who by reason of training and belief are conscientiously opposed to any participation in any national service system would be exempted, and legislative aides admitted to NISBCO, that's this group, that it would be difficult for any registrant to prove by a clear preponderance of evidence that service in general in a military and civilian capacity would be the violation of even the most profound convictions of the registrant. And that's true.
And the hooker in there is the...
you can do civilian service.
Declared by Congress.
Right. Okay.
Because we can get into a lot of wars that are never declared.
Vietnam was never declared.
Right.
That's correct. All right. Therefore, during peacetime, civilian service would become the CO's option. During a time of war declared by Congress, persons who have been who have chosen the civilian service option would be third in line for induction into the armed forces. But during a time of war, conscientious objectors to war would not be required to choose any option. During this time, however, there would be no provisions for conscientious objection to civilian service, as described above. I thought it was in there, Amy. It isn't. I'll have to go to other things that I've read. You could be in something like the Ecology Corps of California. You could work in a hospital. You could, some of them propose almost CCC camps. That goes way back, or YCC camps, where you do projects in national parks. You do construction work. You trail work for the Forest Service. Any one of a number of things. It would be civilian service, not military service. Carrie. The time of war, according to McCloskey's bill, the old setup goes in, and you could declare as a CO.
What if war is not declared?
That's right.
Well,
if war is declared.
I'm just reading the language of McCloskey's bill. Okay? We can come back to some of those things. I think, therefore, we've got several things before us. I think you will read more and more about the registration, and from what I read, that probably will be passed. The reasons that you have a coalition for national service are varied. Unemployment is one of the reasons that many congressmen are for it. Unemployment of minorities is the reason Andrew Young is for it. He told NISBCO when they called him, if you can come up with something else that helps the statistics of my black people that are age 18 to 24 at 40% unemployment, you come up with it. He said, I think this makes some sense. The arguments against it are... we'll get into people who've read the books, and if that's one of the ones you're interested in, okay.
Would they be paid for this service, or is it just
minimal? Mm-hmm. It's minimal pay. It's most of the time, it's probably an allowance for room and board at a given figure, and allowance for some travel, and then pay each month to bring you up to the minimum wage per hour. Some such formula. I've read that it might be $180 a month cash to the people who are in it. But they have a formula to figure the pay. Some of the other statistics, and then we'll move on. At the present time, the people who are opposed to any form at the present time of peacetime conscription say things like this. We have 2.1 million people on active duty right now, and 800,000 more in selective reserves, and another 300,000 in delayed entry reserves. Take a little longer to activate them. The answer from the Pentagon on why we need more at the present time, and I'm quoting a Sojourner's article, and there are six of them Xeroxed around someplace, two of them came back. You can read it later if you want. The military has run scenarios. I guess you're now all familiar with the fact that a lot of war games go on, and they set those up, and that may be very good technique for Pentagon. I don't know. But they set up something called the Nifty Nugget, and in that, Russia attacked Europe, and they calculated a six-week fatality of 500,000 persons. And then said, our present system will not let us continue that ground warfare, therefore our present numbers are not high enough. That's the main thing they have quoted as the reason why the present system is not able to respond. Obviously, that can be debated. First of all, is that an accurate scenario, and a lot of other things, but that's one of the things that has changed. Up until last December, the Pentagon continued to say, the all-volunteer force is working, and we've got good quality people. They are now changing their story. So we're at an old question tonight. Historically, there have been three answers given within the Christian church, all with some roots in the scriptures and all with long traditions, to the answer of a Christian's participation in military service. If you are enough interested, and I wish a lot more people were, if you are enough interested to read that in detail, get Roland Bainton's book, Christian Attitudes Toward Peace and War. Still the finest one written. Roland Bainton has been here many times on faculty. Those three historic positions are crusade, pacifism, and justifiable war. He takes the most seriously justifiable war and pacifism. And he says he has his own bias. There have been very few times when openly and blatantly someone said, I am a crusader for God's holy war. There have been some. The Crusades were some, and those were rightly named. The clearest crusade spirit today would be, or recently, not, I haven't heard it for a long time, it's one of the blessings in my life, kill a commie for Christ. That is a crusade spirit. Bainton says that has never carried the day, that God is pleased when we fight. Okay? The other two approaches both say the ideal is peace. War is evil. But they have different approaches when you are in the midst of a war. And the pacifists, and that has always been a very small minority, the Brethren denomination, for instance, has 250,000 people in the denomination worldwide. The Quakers not much bigger than that, and I don't think all the Mennonites together are much more than that. Those are the only three historic peace churches in the world today. It's a small minority who say, we do not fight. And they obviously quote some passages from Jesus. And they would tell you, as John Howard Yoder did last summer here, we are not called to make history come out right. We're called to be faithful as we understand the teachings of Jesus, and we cannot fight. We cannot kill. St. Martin of Tours is considered to be the first Christian pacifist. There are not many. The Lutheran Church has not had many pacifists in it. The Lutheran Church is part of the vast bulk of the Christian Church since the beginning, and we have what's called the justifiable war criteria. This also says the ideal is peace. War is the last resort. It's the lesser of two evils, but there are some times when that option is better than not getting involved. And that's been our historic position. Let me give you some of the criteria for the just war, just so you know those. Does it have a just cause? That is, and these are, before you would enter it, there are some criteria. And when you've entered it, there are some criteria as to how you wage it. And when you conclude it, there are some criteria about how you treat your enemy. There are three aspects to the justifiable war criteria. Does it have a just cause? And the bulk of the times when the church has said it's a just cause is to protect the innocent or to restore the basic rights of those who of someone who has been wrongfully treated. It's not to start a war, it's to defend someone. That's been usually the cause. Dietrich Bonhoeffer called himself a pacifist throughout his life, entered into an assassination plot of Hitler, and if you remember Jim Fish sitting in this chair, he quoted the Bonhoeffer story that's now very famous. Sometimes, if the coach has a madman driving it, you have to get the driver out of there in order to save the passengers. That was Bonhoeffer's phrase. B, is it truly a last resort? Have all methods short of violence truly been exhausted? C, will it be entered through the nation's properly constituted procedure for declaring war? Is it officially called by whatever way, in our situation, it would be the Congress had declared war. Does it have the reasonable prospect of success? That is, can the goals of the warfare likely be attained without squandering the lives and goods of the people? Will it accomplish more good than the damage it will do? Those are the things that you should have satisfied yourself before you enter. While you're conducting it, there are three. Does the conduct show due proportion between the means used and the ends sought? Does the conduct safeguard non-combatants? And G, does the government promise mercy to the defeated enemy, including assistance with rebuilding what has been destroyed? That's from a Lutheran council document. That's a fairly good summary of things that emerged through Plato, Socrates, and especially St. Augustine as the justifiable war criteria. They're slippery. Dick McSorley says there has never been a just war yet by our own criteria, because when can you say every means has been exhausted? But they are helpful. When you take those criteria, you will see why in World War II there were something like 58 conscientious objectors, Lutherans. And they all knew one another, and I think they were all in prison at one time or another, and thousands of conscientious objectors among Lutherans in Vietnam. Why? If you go down those criteria, Vietnam did not meet a single one of them. Not a single one of our own tradition did it meet. It was never officially declared. Just go right down the list, except mercy to the vanquished. I think the United States has been good on mercy to the vanquished, to my knowledge, in any war we fought. But when the commanding officer said we had to destroy the village to save it, all law of proportionality is just absurd according to our own criteria. So you had a lot of conscientious objectors in Vietnam, and the Lutheran Church was not really ready for that. The dilemma, and then I promise you we'll go on. The dilemma is that if you are a Lutheran and you go to your draft board, the selective service laws of this country were written and still are written to defend the rights of a conscientious objector, namely a pacifist. They really are. They are not written for you. They do not accept a selective conscientious objector. Meaning, if you cannot sign that you are opposed to any military service, most draft boards have no way to say you are a CO. And the justifiable war criteria say you must be a selective something or other. You have to test every war. So your tradition theologically is not built into the selective service system of our country. That's why so many Lutheran young people had such a dilemma in Vietnam. They could not say that they had proved so far in their life that they were completely refused any violence. They could not say they would not have fought in World War II. What they said was, this war, we think, is not justifiable, and in our conscience, we cannot participate in this one. And they were in real trouble. And don't blame the draft board. They were going by the legislation. Even the ones that Paul McCloskey and others have written into conscientious objection in this next draft has the same thing. You have to prove with all kinds of substantiation that you have, by the jobs you have chosen, by your attitudes toward guns, by the theology of the church you go to, another dilemma was an ethical conscientious objector who was not a member of a religious body has trouble here too. I mean, can't you be humanly against killing and not prove you're a member of a pacifist church? Those people have just as much trouble as the Lutheran young people had. So as we got the old problem coming back at us, I think that it's good that Jim said let's have a forum on it, and that you begin to talk and know some of the history and some of the resources that are available to you, because it's a sticky one. The estimate is that something like 250,000 young people might refuse even registration. That's Nisbeko's quote. And one of their appeals to the Armed Service Committee is you're going to rip this country the way we've just started to get healed if you bring this again and cause the some people going to Canada and other people yelling traitor, and some families having a prisoner of war and other families having a person whose country this no longer was. Those were painful years. Our trouble is we don't face it till we're in the middle of it. Then it's so explosive we can't talk coolly about it. And after 72, I didn't get invited to do anything on peace war. I started getting invitations on simple life because the peace war issue was over. That's tragic. This is the time we ought to be able to think through theologically where we stand, not after the thing has started and it's so explosive that you're You're a traitor if you're questioning the Congress of the United States. This is the night to talk about it, because I think within the next 2 months we're going to have some legislation. So much. Lots of people have ideas, questions, and have done some reading, so it's all
over. As far as the Lutheran Church goes, does the individual have to make up his mind as to whether the war meets those criteria? Does the church stand behind its members?
Yes.
And in what way?
Yes.
How do they support?
All right. Let's just answer that one very briefly and see how many other questions we have tonight. I ordered three of these from the Augsburg Publishing House. This has the Lutheran position. It has how the Lutherans traditionally have said your conscience is informed. In other words, how do you make a decision? What does it mean to be a conscientious objector? What role do others have in the formation of conscience? What role does Scripture play? What role does our theological tradition play? What role does the rest of the community play? A pastor, what role does he play? And the Lutherans, I think, by and large, supported through counseling, through writing letters that tried to clearly say, this young person is being faithful to our Lutheran tradition. It's not just that he is saying, I'm against this war because this is the one I'd have to go to. That's what, that's the accusation of a selective conscientious objector. I saw an 18-year-old accused on the floor of an ALC convention. Some guy stood up and said, of course you're opposed to this one. You're chicken. This is the one you'd have to fight in. Didn't hear him at all on the dilemma of selective conscientious objector. So that there were hundreds of letters that said, this is faithful to a justifiable war criteria. Spelled that out for the young person and said, he legitimately can be considered a conscientious objector to this particular involvement in Vietnam. And some draft boards went with that. So yes, the church set up selective service counseling through Lutheran Council USA. Charles Lutz was head of it nationally. Participated in CCCO, Coordinating Committee for Conscientious Objectors, NISBCO. The office sent materials to anybody who asked, so the church did respond, yes. But it's I've already described the dilemma of responding because we are not a peace church. Okay.
And even right now, we're not even involved in a war. And trying to start the draft up again. Can you go in with a conscience knowing we're not in a war, and when one begins that you don't think it's justifiable, it's too late to back out there.
It would be very hard from our tradition to oppose being registered. There's no war going on. How do I know I'm already know I'm opposed to the next one? The Lutheran tradition would have you stuck on that one. It really is. Do you sense that point? That's a critical point of a real dilemma.
There was a statement in the Sojourners article that I thought was really good. They asked the question, what's the purpose of draft registration?
Yeah.
And it only is, there's only one thing, and that is that it's a military, it's a preparation for a war. You have people already registered. The only purpose of having them registered is for when the time comes when we do have a war, and then they're already registered for that. So the only purpose of registration is about military conscription or the draft. So that's the only purpose behind registration, according to the...
So you either have to get pacifist now or register and take your chance. Because your Lutheran tradition won't stand you in any sense.
Well, from what you said, I don't think there's any choice on conscientious objector when there's no war. I mean, that question doesn't even come up. You said that.
Okay. Let's stick on that one for a little bit. I'll get you, Scott. I see you. I would like to see at the present time more Lutheran, more widespread alarm expressed to the people who are key. That we fail to do that. We don't know that that's an option right now. The NISBCO and other people are testifying and writing letters and what have you. So right now, you're not asked to register. We do have some time, if you feel strongly, to have your pastor back home or go to an assembly of Lutherans or I don't know, and join the people who are criticizing the thing if that's the way you feel. when the time to register come, and I wish I was better prepared because I read everything that I have, and I don't know what the option would be. There is some advantage, if you are a conscientious objector, to stating that at the very start. And even if you're not a member of a peace church, if you don't say that at the beginning and have in your files your substantiation of that, it's harder to get that later. So I think that's for the most extreme, and words are hard to come by, the most extreme is to be a non-cooperator, and the end of that is usually jail. A non-cooperator is one who says, I don't care what your laws say, you have no power over me, and you do not answer their mail, and you do not register, and you do not do anything else. The end result of that is jail, and that's always been a very small group, because the Selective Service tries to give room for your conscience and conscientious objection. And most people at least cooperate with the thing instead of just saying, you don't have any effect over me. So you do have some choices. You can act now. You can register and hope that there isn't a draft later. You can register as a conscientious objector and start that process as a Lutheran. And you can be a non-cooperator. I think you almost always have those four choices. I'm saying that one of registering as a conscientious objector, even to the registration of people, is difficult. And if they do it by computer, I don't think you're ever going to be asked.
What is the chance of the conscientious objector going to prison? Is that feasible? Does that happen?
Yes. Tim Martin, who was the woodcutter here, was in prison as a Roman Catholic conscientious objector. Jim Smith spent a lot more time than I did visiting with him. Do you remember? I think he was a conscientious objector, wasn't he?
Well, he was a service, and then.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tim was in service under the agreement that he was a non-combatant, and he was ordered to take part in combat drill, and he refused.
I see.
On the basis of the agreement that he had gone in as a non-combatant, they said, "Well, we're not going to put you into combat, but you've got to do this drill." And he wouldn't do it, so they court-martialed.
Is there any possibility, who sets up and is saying what a conscientious objector is? In other words, that if you're just part of the Lutheran Church, that the way that things are set up now, that isn't going to work out for you. Is there any chance of these things being changed, or who sets up that criteria? What part of the government? Is that the Selective Service Board? Is that in the Constitution?
Let me get that, but first let me go back to Scott, because I forgot it, and if I don't look up, I'll forget it. Then I'll do this. Scott? Is it similar?
It was just the fact that if you are going to be a conscientious objector, you have to register anyway, right?
Yes, so. That's correct. You do cooperate and you register as a CO. The purpose of this is a special form for COs from the Selective Service. The purpose of this questionnaire is to assist your local board in determining whether you qualify for classification as a conscientious objector. Before you answer the questions, you may wish to read the pamphlet, Conscientious Objector, which is available at your local board office. All draft boards should have that, and I think they do. And that's a fairly detailed description of your rights and what it means in their language to be a CO. Printer type on separate sheets, etc. To be classified as a conscientious objector, you must be opposed to war in any form. Your objection must be based on moral or ethical beliefs or beliefs which are commonly accepted as religious. Okay, that's where the ethical humanist was in trouble. Your beliefs must influence your life as the belief in God influences the life of one who is a traditionally religious conscientious objector. To qualify, your conscience must be spurred by deeply held moral, ethical, or religious beliefs which would give you no peace if you allowed yourself to become a combatant member of the armed forces. That's fair, isn't it? I mean, I think that's trying to really find out whether it's a matter of conscience, because that's what the government, when they first set up this option, wanted to protect those people where it was really a matter of conscience.
Fine, it's worth. I'm not sure how.
Now, here's what you attach in your statement. Describe the beliefs which are the basis for your claim for classification as a CO. Will your beliefs permit you to serve in a position in the armed forces where the use of weapons is not required? Some do. Medics, There are COs who cooperate even to the point of being medics. If not, why not? If you can't even serve and be a medic, why not? Explain how you acquired the beliefs which are the basis of your claim. Your answer may include such information as the influence of family members or other persons, religious training, experiences at school, membership in organizations, books, readings which influence you. You may wish to provide any other information which will help in explaining why you believe as you do. 4. Explain what most clearly shows that your beliefs are deeply held. How can you illustrate these beliefs in your present life or past life? Do your beliefs affect the way you live? Describe how your beliefs affect the type of work you will do to earn a living or the types of activity you participate in during non-working hours. 6. Describe any specific actions or incidents of your life that show you believe as you do. Those are the statements you file, and the individual draft board says yes or no to your application to be a CO. Then you have other choices after they say yes or no.
What is the basis, though, for their decision? I mean, do they have constitutional, or do they have law? What do they have to back up their saying that you, well, they say because you do this or that, you are not qualified as a conscientious objector? What do they have to back that up?
This is official, what I've read. Their judgment, then, is their own. It's your local draft board.
Yeah, but I think what he's trying to get at is that an act of Congress that set that up in the first place? Is that what you're trying to do?
Exactly.
That's the criterion there. And I think a real problem is that from place to place throughout the country, draft boards weren't consistent. In Vietnam, for instance, from one state to the next, you just didn't have the same chance of getting that CO status. If you lived in Milwaukee or Minneapolis, you had a lot better chance of being a CO than if you lived in any of the southern states, from what I understand. Because the board that made up your local draft board were the ones who interpreted that statement, or those statements there.
Scott?
Do you have a list of the exceptions? For instance, single male in the family and all that, is it going to be like that? Where if you were a single male in the family, you didn't go?
I don't have those. I assume, I'm just assuming that we have a fairly long tradition, and if it goes beyond registration to draft, it will have age, marital status, in college, certain occupations, single male in the family, that probably all of that, all we're talking about is the possibility of CO, not the rest of that, because they're really not at that point yet in Congress. They're not at those kinds of details of legislation at this point.
So you were saying that instead of registering, they might try and waive the Privacy Act, and instead of going to information itself, then there wouldn't be any massive registration. How would you get your CO status?
It would be very difficult. You would have to, I don't know.
Well, that sounds like part of this bill, too. If you were brought into that, you'd take the 1 year of civilian service.
No, the question is for registration, not national service, not draft, just registration. If it's done by computer, and your school files, any place you've worked, your social security number, any place that you're on a computer, if that's the way the registration is done, it seems to me you have to take the initiative to somehow get into that system to stop it, because you'll never be asked to come and sign at a desk or to sign up. That's my understanding. Keith?
Yeah. Can you avoid registration if you join the National Guard? Because I know a couple of people that joined the National Guard and didn't have to sign up for the draft last time, and Vietnam War.
All right, all I can do is answer from what I've read in the last 2 days, Keith. My understanding is, at the present time, what they're saying is, we are not talking draft, we're talking only registration. The legislations about draft, almost all of them have some options. Like civilian service, 2 years in the armed service, 6 years in the National Guard or Reserve. At that point, that's probably going to be an option. At the registration time, none of the people that are pushing for registration want any options because they're saying all we want is to register, hoping we'll never have a draft, but we need the registration now. The reason, the Pentagon in testimony said, right now it would take us 7 months to get anything going. We're so poorly equipped to get something going. And they said, if everybody is registered, then if we have to have a draft, we've already come down a long way in that very, very long time period. And the argument is, if we need it, we're not prepared for it. I mean, that, see what I mean? I'm not sure that I've answered Keith. Probably National Guard, especially during any kind of peacetime draft, will be an option. Sounds like, yes.
You do have to register, though.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right.
You know, the whole thing is like a fantasy. If the country were threatened, now I'm not talking about my own, what I would do, but my guess is that if the country were threatened, all you'd have to do would be to set up an office in the cities, and the places would be flooded. You know, I mean, how were armies rounded up before? Surely it didn't probably take 7 months. I mean,
it took better than 2 years in World War II to really mobilize things.
Okay, but that's not because people weren't registered. I mean, maybe the factories weren't tuned up.
But it,
maybe the armaments weren't built. I mean, a lot of factories had to be turned over to build airplanes and all that. But I can't...
It took some time to get the mechanics of registration going, yes. But it does take time to get this machinery going.
It's inconceivable to me. I just can't believe it.
Well, it's just how long does it take you to get your income tax back, and that's already set up.
Okay, that's the fantasy angle right there. I mean, you know, if you've got to have everything in quintuplicate, then there's no, you know, what's the press? They're talking about, like, oh, there's going to be a disaster, 500,000 people are going to be killed. I mean, the whole thing is not being done in those terms at all. It's pure fantasy. It's absolute pure fantasy.
Let me get, if I understand your point, Keith, it's that if there were, in fact, the emergency that they envision, if Russia attacked, just take the scenario, if Russia attacked Europe and this country wanted to respond, you're saying the fact that everybody was registered would not be that much of a great step forward, and that we would have the people we needed out of loyalty, and so this is useless? Where is the fantasy? Okay.
Yeah.
That's one of the arguments against the registration, that your scenario, that any scenario that says we need that we need more than 2.1 million ground troops because of some attack is not taking into account the way the next war is going to be fought anyway. I mean, that's even the people who are not pacifists say that we don't need a registration because the next war is not going to have soldiers fighting one another over in Europe on ground forces. So it's a complicated thing. I mean, you get funny coalitions of people who take on an issue because they're coming from such diverse viewpoints.
I'd like to address myself to the Andrew Young thing, too.
Yeah.
I mean, if this country is not willing to arrange itself in such a way that people can be useful, how is the government going to manage? I can't understand how. I mean, if the country is already suffering some kind of an illness that causes people to be useless, then how is the government going to make that right? It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's...
Why does the government just fire all those unemployed people and pay them what they would have anyway?
Well, there is some that now you're into a. Now you're into a political debate, and that's all right. I mean, there were about 2 million young people that FDR put into programs called CCC camps and WPA and other things, and some people are opposed to big government answer to a question, and other people said that brought us out of a depression. I mean, I'm not saying that that's not a viewpoint, but you get other people, and apparently including Andrew Young, who feels that at the present time that's at least one answer to high unemployment and listlessness and drugs and everything else on city streets, especially among black youth.
I wonder if the military is really an answer to the drug problem.
Andrew Young is not in favor of the draft. I quoted him only on national service, and he's hoping it has nothing to do with the military. But I'm telling you, that's a strange coalition, because 99% of what I read were people who hoped it was intimately connected with the military, so he's in with a strange group. So is Mark Hatfield. Mark Hatfield is articulate on a kind of peace stand. Yes, Carrie.
Well, that's great for people that are unemployed. No, but this national service is for everyone. It requires everyone to be involved, even if you're in school.
That's correct.
Even if you might have a career already outlined ahead of you. No matter what, it's everybody, whether you might be, have a good job, whether you are employed, you have to give it up to do this for your country. It's not only for just the unemployed inner city people. It's for everyone.
You can even go so far as to say that some of the opponents of it say that these young people who didn't especially want to do it are taking jobs from some older people who did want to do it. You're increasing the workforce of 17 and 18 year olds, and we already have unemployment among some other people who might do those menial jobs. Yeah, that's part of the argument.
What's the use of having pushing a CO into war? They know darn well he's not going to be loyal, and he'd probably end up getting his butt shot off anyway. I don't see what the point is. Isn't a point of war is having loyal people serving your country? Obviously, a CO is not really into war. So what's the point of having him going into war anyway?
I think, if I understand it correctly, that's what the Pentagon and the military hoped that the all-volunteer forces would do. Get people who wanted to get over the tremendous rift in this country after Vietnam, and up until last December they were saying it's working. Now they're saying it's not working, that they have that they're getting very few of the top people out of high school. They're getting a very high minority. I think it's something like 40% of the all-volunteer force is minority, and so they're coming in because of unemployment, not because it's a free choice. So now they're saying it isn't working, and I guess they, I don't know. I think you've got a point, but I don't know how to answer it. Jack has had his hand up for a long time.
2 points. One, the Right to Privacy Act is the one that really upsets me, too, is that any time you've had any dealings with the government agency, so that information is open then to be used by other agencies. I don't know that that's already happening.
Not supposed to be.
I know, but I'm not so sure. So that's really upsetting. There's another alternative to avoiding the whole thing. There are some friends of mine in California who were, let's say in their 20s, late teens, early 20s, during the Vietnam War, who had children. And they knew that eventually their children were going to be faced with the same dilemma they were. And they never got into the computer system. Children that were born at home, that never registered in public schools, that never received Social Security cards, never got driver's licenses, that were totally outside the computer system. And it takes a hell of an effort to do that, but it is possible to do it.
And never receive pay except cash.
That's right.
Yeah, that's very hard to do.
It's very difficult to do, but it is possible to do.
Yeah. Some of you read some other stuff, and just bring that in.
I like what Jack is saying, because that's exactly what I'm thinking about. Seems to me the issue tonight is not the draft or not war or conscious objection. That's part of it, but it's a registration of all people
age 18 throughout the whole country. And there's if you permit me, I'd like to read this. I read 1984 at a very impressionable age, and that really, I have paranoia, that book. But anyway, the registration, can I read this?
Sure.
Soldier's Magazine. Young men and possibly young women would have to provide their names, addresses, ages, birth dates, physical characteristics, etc., to a government agency. Thereafter, they would be required to keep that agency informed every time they went on a trip, every time they moved, etc. It is, in short, a method of control over young people so that the government at all times knows where they are and how to conscript them. This represents the worst aspects of totalitarianism, and that's what scares me. It says to our young people that their lives and futures are owned by the government, and that the government intends to keep track of its property in case it is ever needed to kill or be killed. Right. And that's what scares me.
Okay, now that you have already given that information.
Yeah. Well,
when you get a driver's license, I don't know. I'm sure there are other times when that information has already been given.
But to go along with even the registration permits that even more so to happen.
Oh, I know.
I mean, for sure. And if we're all at age 18, we got to put our names in. That's scary because they have control at that point.
Who knows what the next step is?
And a computerized registration system where I don't even know if I'm registered, and all of a sudden I get a notice that says I have to go to war. I mean, that is really scary.
Let me give you the other side of that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Part of our religious tradition is also living in a society that includes some loss of freedom because we're part of a society, so that Social Security and Medicaid and other things really are HEW has some things where most of us know some people that we're very glad are in their computer. I mean, they're getting old age benefits and Medicare and what have you.
Yeah.
It's when you have come to the position of such a lack of trust that you're assuming that they want your name in order that they own your property, that's really a very sad state. And when someone has come to that, okay, but I'm saying traditionally we have not been that suspicious of the government, and it's kind of a new. Jack commented when he and I were of this age, there wasn't anybody in my acquaintance who would talk about resistance, tax resistance, CO resistance, or anything else. There's not believe in anything they tell you, which is part of our reality, but I don't want to go so far in that I'm paranoid about everything the government starts or anytime somebody wants my name.
Yeah. Can I respond to
sure.
that? Yeah, I have no qualms about registering for Social Security. When my father died, I got lots of money to help me go to school. No question about it. I don't mind putting my name in when I know that it's a justifiable thing for health, education, welfare,
sure.
No problem. But the only point of registration, in my mind, is for future military preparation,
yes.
Future war. That's what the registration at this point means. If it comes time for me to register for a driver's license, I'll be happy to do that. Because I do agree.
Yep.
There is some support that goes into just living in a country. But to say at age 18 that I must register, when the only point of that registration is for future military conscription, then I question that. I really do.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I handed out the three booklets on the National Service is I think that one's as scary as the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And most people think that's a very innocuous way of having some young people off the streets and working in the woods. And I just think that you really have to look through that one. Okay. Yes, Libby.
I have a couple things that have crossed my mind. Answers, but they just pitch us that are close to it. One is thinking of Iran, and I know right now it's probably not an example to hold up in any great light, but I do remember when I was there that all young people were required to give service to the country, and it was their option whether it was military or civilian fire.
No.
Okay. And I remember really balking at that. I thought it would mean that they had, at least had a choice, that they didn't have to be drafted into the military. And the alternative was to go into a health corps, education corps. And I balked at that just because I don't like somebody telling me what to do. But it seemed to do a lot in our eyes at that time. It seemed to do a lot for the country in that a country with a very poor standard of living was getting some of their own people out into kind of an internal peace corps kind of thing, rather than it relying on Americans or whoever to come in and fix them up. And it seemed like a way to get their own people involved with their own people in the community. Second thing, Mary just whispered something about going to Bethlehem about conscription stuff, and I just thought I'd bring up the Merton thing about Nolan in the end, that it was at the time of registration that Jesus was born, and according to Thomas Merton, he thinks it's a very significant situation that everybody was heading to their city, whatever it might have been, to put their name down and to be enrolled, and Jesus was born at that time, but he wasn't born in that crowd of people. There wasn't any room for him in the inn. It was such a crowd. Everybody was flooding into Bethlehem. There wasn't any room. And he was always on the outside of that. The only people that responded to him were like nomadic, jobless, wandering shepherds that weren't involved in that enrollment.
Can I say something about that, the service thing there? In this book, The National Service Debate, it's an excellent book, and it's a scary book. With that, the national service thing, there's an example in here of Hitler's Youth Corps. There was a certain name for it that started around 1936. It originally started as a recreational and a social type thing. And it eventually got into, they ended up having rallies at schools and at factories, and you were required to go to these rallies. And eventually, if you weren't a part of this youth corps, you know, you were really ostracized by society. And it turned into a very nasty thing. That could be some of the dangers. I can envision some of the congressmen that are talking about this. One guy's talking about uniforms, nice blue uniforms for all the people, and putting different moral ideas, you know, on the people in it. It's a scary thing. Really scary.
Mary?
I think a lot of that. Pacific Lutheran University is an example. Our daughter Karen told us that about a month ago there was a group of pranksters at PLU that put up on the bulletin board a big, you know, flash news break. Young men and young women 18 to 26 have just, it's passed on us that they've just been required to register. And Karen said, nothing hit PLU like that since she's been there. Girls started crying hysterically. Guys there made so many long distance calls, you couldn't get through. Everybody stormed into the chaplain's office. Their teachers, they went, the whole student body was just in an uproar over the possibility of that. And it wasn't discovered till the end of the day that that was just some big joke. But I just thought, you know, if that's how kids in college responded, I wonder if they're going to have an easy time getting that through.
Dave Moan, and then Scott, and then Peter again.
Well, I was just wondering if when Linda was talking about Iran, and Jim mentioned the Hitler thing, if there's been any investigations where the service type of thing works, or in a society where it does work. I'm thinking, when I visited relatives in Norway several years ago, I had several cousins that were graduating from high school, and there, everyone puts in a year of service after high school. It's just sort of, this is what you do. I don't know any of the details behind it, but it seems to work. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. I'm just wondering if there's been any investigation of places where it does work, other than things like Nazi Germany.
Other countries that have it? Anybody know? Sweden?
They did in Germany.
Germany? Scott?
Practical point, the political end of trying to set up something like the national service, whatever, would have so much opposition just because of the financial burden that would be. That would be a whole new department. That would be a whole new bunch of people that would be going out and spending much more money just hiring all these people than they would if they wanted to, like somebody mentioned, take all these kids out and just give them the money, or these young people in the age group, they could probably give them the money and save setting up this whole large political machine that would come out of this.
One of the problems, however, with the all-volunteer force is its cost. Way above what they estimated. They estimate it takes $1,000 in recruiter and publicity and advertisement costs for every recruit they get, and they've had to give so much incentive and get the pay up to attract them that it's that they could. That's one of the problems about the all volunteer.
But that's suggesting, which is the obvious thing, and that's what they're covering up evidently at this point, is that this national service thing would eventually become another way of, you know, having people for service for war, for killing.
Peter and then Laura.
Just as a response or a plea for what Mary just said about people at PLU reacting as they did, that is, anybody who's, you know, 18 to 26, there's a possibility that come October 1st, we're going to have to face that issue of registration. I mean, it hasn't gone through yet, but there's one bill that the president would order the Selective Service to commence registration by October 1st, 1979. That's this year. I mean, this is not something that's just off in the blue corner. I mean, it's really right here, right now. And we may have to, all of us, and this age group may have to face that very shortly. So it's not something that just passes by.
One, two, three, four, five. There are six bills in Congress for a draft, for ways in which the draft would be reenacted. Yes.
John, now is the time that people feel strongly about it to write letters to their Congress.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what do we do about it? Okay, you know, you're worried about it.
Do they?
Yeah.
Well, they are.
Yes, they do.
Yes. That's my assumption from other things like world hunger issues and living in Washington for a while and knowing at least several congressmen and a senator. Yes, they are not all read. They are counted, and the aide will tell a congressman every day the count on a critical measure, so many for, so many against, and the ones that are written instead of an obvious form that you've signed are weighted more heavily. A one with a lot of names on the bottom, or a mimeograph one that you've signed, I don't know how they go to weight it, but one that's written out with your reasons is weighted, yeah. And they get fewer than you think.
Yeah.
The welfare reform bill, Mary tells people about this because we knew Gene McCarthy fairly well, the welfare reform bill, which we thought was an important one way back, he said, Mary, I got four letters from the state of Minnesota for it, from the whole state of Minnesota for it. He said, I thought it was important too. I can't afford to spend any time on it. My constituency isn't interested in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Laura.
I'm just wondering what the rest of the world is going to think if we come up with a registration and a draft. If they're going to think that we have something in mind for war and if other countries are going to react towards that.
One of the things I thought when you started talking about it was that if you're going to start getting lots of soldiers kind of lined up, then that's going to make you a bit more happy about not starting a war, but about kind of becoming involved in a war. I mean, if you haven't got the resources close at hand, you're going to be a bit more cautious. Mm-hmm. If they're there, then you're going to think, well, perhaps we ought to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to make it easier for someone maybe to make a decision. Like, if you made a decision and you had to do all this process to lead up to it, things can change, but if you can make a quick decision, get things going quickly, then there's an opportunity for something to happen that probably might be probably.
Was there something over here? Is there a hand up over here? But yes, Peter.
Just as a response to Peter, what the United States might happen is Jim Weaver, Democrat from Oregon, has some statements in this, which is really good to read, I think. And one that struck me was, the only place in the world where we have been rattling our sabers of late is the Persian Gulf, specifically in Saudi Arabia. Both Defense Secretary Harold Brown and Energy Secretary James Schlesinger, whatever the word is, have said within the past several weeks that we must take any action that is appropriate, including the use of military force, to protect the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf.
Well,
yeah, and then he goes on to say, and this is interesting, I like what he's saying here, we must all ask ourselves if we believe it be worthwhile
to send our sons to die in the Persian Gulf so that we can continue to fuel our innovation. Is it worthwhile to go to war so that we don't have to wait in line at the gas station to buy gas to fritter away? And what he's talking about is, you know, are we preparing for war to keep our expensive habits? And if so, is that justifiable? Is that legitimate? And the whole thing of registration is locked right into that stuff.
He is a congressperson from Oregon, if anybody's from Oregon, and he's the leader of the opposition to the draft, Weaver, Democrat, Oregon. So one of the things you can do is to send a letter of thanks to one who is doing what you think ought to be, or saying what you once said. That probably carries as much weight as trying to change the mind of somebody else. Jim Fish?
Lori.
One thing I'd be interested in, how many people here feel like they're pacifists, because you just said like the traditional Lutheran stance is justifiable war. And that means that if you go to war, it might not be for, I mean, you'd have to face up to whether you are going to go or not and face your decision. You can't apply the conscientious objection, you have to go to jail, probably. But that, I don't know, it seems to me that should be irrelevant. If you're going to war and you feel it's justifiable, what's wrong with registering? Myself, you know, I'm not saying what I believe, but if you are believing in justifiable war, you're saying if our country goes to war, it's going to be worthless. But if you believe in justifiable war, it might be really valid. It might be another World War II where you might be like Bonhoeffer and feel like you're really doing something. But I'm just interested in how many people would, in here would call themselves pacifists, and how many people would call themselves would be in favor of justifiable war.
Yeah, that's the hard part.
Yeah, that's
I don't know.
Hard part right now.
And I don't want a guy putting a gun in my hand so I can find out.
Yeah.
I guess.
No, but if you were a pacifist, you wouldn't ever look at him.
But I don't know if I am, you know.
You could apply for conscientious objector. You could go to jail. You could refuse to do it. But if you're at the justifiable war, then you could say, I don't believe that war's a good thing. But if the situation comes up and I think it's right, then I'm going to defend or save somebody else.
So I guess, in my point of view, for fighting the registration is not within me if I'm a pacifist or justifiable war or what. The reason I'm against registration is because of the people in my shoes, I think. The ruined lives of people going to Canada, of people who don't know, who are just afraid. The people that will go to jail for 2 years, have that on their record, and how that will affect their lives in the future. I guess I see, with the registration, a lot of lives really altered dramatically for the rest of the person's life.
So would you see a solution to be what Keith said, is if something happened where you really think you should go to war, you'd make sure that you went out and fought, so you wouldn't need to worry about registering? What do you see the answer to be?
Now, I'm not sure. You know, I don't know.
It seems to me what Peter King just pointed out was that if we do have people registered, that gives the government kind of a, you know, we're all in this military pool, and they've got us all in that little bag. And it, what he said, you know, the government may not be quite as cautious. In other words, when the Persian Gulf thing doesn't quite go through the way they want it, because they've got all of us registered, they've got this little military pool, they may be very prone to say, yeah, let's go, we've got it. Whereas if they don't have it, then to push the military, if they might not be quite as ready to do that. And that's the thing about registration. If we all say, yeah, let's register up. And you know, no draft so far. But we're all there. All they have to do is say, draft. And we're in. And perhaps what Peter said is really true. You know, so, and that's what scares me about the registration. Well, I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about
those poor people that are just registering about.
I think in answer to Lori, I think that's something to do with every person. Personally, I will never go to a war. That's just something that's in me. I mean, I've had three brothers in the war, and all of them are injured. One of them was a POW. He was horribly mutilated, and the other two were, well, neither of them are normal at all. And personally, I would go to Canada. And I think that has to do with the individual, because I don't see what any war has done for our country, especially Vietnam. It's ruined our family, and I don't think I'd go at all. And I think in answer to Lori, you know, I think it has to do with the individual, because there's certain different things in each family, and that's just the way I feel.
So, yeah, that's what it all comes down to.
Tom?
But
the way you just described that, that would make you a selective CO, and legally, they would say that that's not, you know, that doesn't fall under guidelines for justifiable being a CO who would not be able to go to war, or who would not participate in war, because you're bringing in, it's not a deep religious belief. If your brothers have been mutilated or something like that, that's a physical thing, and perhaps, well, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say here, but that wouldn't fall in their guidelines for being a deep religious belief that overrides all your, the way you treat people, or the way you want to treat people in your life. So.
Right.
I wouldn't know a way for them to tell me if I could be a CO or not. I'd just be down anyway. So that's not the point. It's a personal belief in me.
Wonder what will ever happen if Canada goes to war.
I guess I would.
The option of going to Canada is not without pain. Yeah, you all know that. There's a lot of pain to that, too. Yeah.
If registration passes,
yep.
And Daniel Yoder in Indiana or Minnesota or wherever, he'll go down to the office and say, names like John Howard Yoder and books and all this tradition behind him.
Yep.
And he'll not have a difficult time. Is that correct?
I would think that would be correct.
Right. But if Jim Smith goes down.
I'm already registered. I registered when I was 18.
Oh.
You know, I registered, I was.
Okay, well, a Lutheran goes down.
Yeah.
And the Lutheran could talk about people that they've met or books that they've read, but we don't have the tradition behind it, too, and we don't have the theology. We've got a just war thing, and that doesn't apply to the registration at all. But Daniel will not have to register, probably.
He'll have to register.
He'll register as a CO.
But I think he will register as a CO.
But it'll be. Don't stop.
See, that's also part of my problem. I registered. When I registered, the draft was over. You had to register, but there was no more draft. So
yeah.
I went in with kind of a jovial heart when I registered. Mm-hmm. You know, and now here it comes back again. My name's already in. What chance?
I don't know if that would really affect the final decision, though. The fact that you registered when you were required to by law at a time.
But I didn't claim the CO status then.
How much room is there to change as a room?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Peter?
I'm sorry to talk too much. You know, on the surface, it could seem like, that registration is just, it seems like it's no big deal. But I personally think that it is a big deal. And I'd like just to read this little bit from this article, if you permit me. It says, draft registration is the first step in the process of restoring peacetime conscription to the United States. Arguments that the proposals cover only registration and not actual draft induction are nonsense. The only purpose of draft registration is military conscription. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to, I think Lori was getting at something when she talked about pacifism. I think that none of us here want to go to war. And I think, I would guess so anyway. And I don't think you have to be a pacifist to say, I will not register. I don't want to register. I don't want to give the government the opportunity to further their military ventures. I think we can say that now without being a pacifist.
Yeah, but you won't have to register.
I know I won't.
It's all going to be automatic.
Well,
that's a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one really ought to be highlighted. I mean, you
sure, that's the scary one. I mean,
people can write on just that issue. That if you're going to register, it should not be at the expense of the Privacy Act.
Right.
It should be in the old registration system. Libby?
Could you kind of say something about the history of registration? I just remembered right now that people had said Jim had to register in 18. Yeah, I didn't have to do that, but I had forgotten about that. Did people have to register at World War II or at times in between? What's the history on registration?
No, yeah.
Go ahead.
Can I add one more thing to Peter's before you get off that? About the registration thing, I saw an article in the paper a month or two ago that said first test of draft failed. I kind of went good, so I decided to read the article. And it was in a committee, and apparently one of the suggestions of the committee was reinstating the draft or something like that, and it failed. But at the end of the article, registration was passed, you know, by a large margin in the committee. So, you know, even the media, it looked, if I wouldn't have read the article, I wouldn't have known that. Yet I got down to the bottom, and from what Sojourners and the other groups are saying, that they got exactly what they wanted out of that.
Not the first day.
Yeah.
Yes, there was registration. When I turned 18, I think it was,
yeah.
You registered and got classified and carried a draft card at all times.
Was that war time?
No, that was prior to the Korean War.
The first peacetime conscription was after World War II. We had never had it before, and it ended in 1972.
The peacetime conscription was actually just simply a carryover, was it not?
Yes.
When the war ended, this conscription just went off.
The registration continued. That's correct. Let me just summarize a little bit, and then you can stay if you want. I think we have three or four issues, and I didn't mind that they were intertwined all night because they are related. I think that it's a good time for all of us to do some searching that we have not done, and that's in our own attitude. Lori's question, I guess, where are we on this issue? I gave you one book, Christian Attitudes Toward Peace and War by Bainton. I would also strongly recommend Religion and Violence by Robert McAfee Brown, which we read last fall here in the winter program. The reason I recommend that is Brown is honest in saying he has flip-flopped four times on this issue. I'm kind of leery of the one who has it all together and anything else is wrong, and he knows it so well that he's never changed his mind. I think when somebody honestly says he was born into a liberal pacifist home, so he was a pacifist because that's the way his family taught. Then came World War II, and he said to himself, you are sounding high and mighty and you're going to stay out of the conflict and you think you're morally pure compared to those who are going in and getting bloody, and then you're going to step in during the reconciliation and help clean up Europe when you weren't there during the fight. And he thought he was a pacifist for the wrong reasons, so he went into the Navy. Then he's rethought that since, and people like Martin Luther King and Dom Elder Camara have convinced him of the power of nonviolence, and especially of that being consistent with the teachings of Jesus. And now the Namibia and Third World liberation needs, he says, I'm not sure I can tell them not to be violent. So he has flip-flopped four times at least, and you just kind of move with him in his dilemma. And there is no unambiguous place to stand. There is no guiltless place to stand, and there's no one place that has all the Bible on their side. If there were, I think we could solve it tonight. We've got the Bible and we got brains. It's not that simple. Okay. So the only way you can do that is to move into it and find out where you are, and there are some helps. I also recommend this as a summary of where the Lutherans have come down historically on that. That's one thing. It's a good time to kind of sort that through for yourself, because ultimately you're the one that has to say where you are on that. That's the background. Now, there are other issues. Registration, Privacy Act, draft, those are all part of this year's congressional action, it looks like, and I think we ought to keep on top of it so that we're understand what's going on and do some more sharing while you're here or clip newspapers I've got the materials. There's a shelf now in my office and it can be a lending library, but it's readable. I can't tell you that the stuff here is completely objective. It isn't. I don't know where to get the other side clearly articulated. I think we tend to hear it, but this tends to be more those who really question registration, draft, and a Christian's participation in war.